Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we'll speak with Heather Parton, better known as Digby, about the Trump regime and how everything is awful. Folks, that sense of impending doom you're feeling may be related to the fact that we are, in fact, doomed. Then we'll speak with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, about his new book, Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. But first, it was a heck of a week for Donald Trump. First, he conned much of the political press into believing that he had fulfilled a campaign promise when he cut a deal with Carrier Corp to keep around 1,000 jobs, that the company had planned to move to Monterrey, Mexico, in Indiana. A few things you need to know. First, Carrier is very profitable. Second, it's already heavily subsidized by the taxpayers. Got stimulus funds to keep those jobs in Indiana. It got state grants to keep those jobs in Indiana. Its parent company gets $1.5 billion per year from the federal government to subsidize its R&D costs. That, by the way, is 23 times what it hopes to save by moving those plants in Indiana to Mexico. And now Donald Trump gave them another sweetheart deal. We're not exactly sure about the details. And it will only keep around half of those jobs in Indiana. Every company can now claim that it's moving jobs overseas and hope to be similarly rewarded. Now, Trump, if you'll remember, promised to get tough on offshorers. He said he'd enact new tariffs, and he ended up bribing them with tax dollars, with your money, and that's not what he promised on the campaign trail. And the really striking thing is how little Trump got out of this deal, the great negotiator. Carrier's move represented only a tiny, tiny fraction of the job that its parent company, United Technologies, plans on offshoring to Mexico and Poland in the next few years as part of a big restructuring plan. It gave up almost nothing. It got concessions for it. It got good PR. And of course, Trump got a great photo op and a good news cycle. The taxpayers take a loss. And in the big scheme of things, it does virtually nothing for American workers. I think this is the type of model we should get used to. Trump also stumbled through a rough week in international relations. He wants to build a new tower in Manila, and he happened to have a nice phone call with deranged Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte, who is engaged in an orgy of extrajudicial killings of alleged drug dealers. So Trump invites this guy to the White House. This is a guy who said his own daughter was a, quote, drama queen for alleging that she had been raped. A real sweetheart. Trump also wants to build a new luxury hotel in Taiwan. So he gets on the phone with the new president of that country, Tsai Ing-wen. Only problem is that no U.S. president or president-elect has spoken with a Taiwanese leader since 1979, when we broke off diplomatic relations with Taiwan as part of making peace with China. The Chinese are not happy. Diplomatic heads are exploding all over the world. And this clown hasn't even been inaugurated. And the thing is that he doesn't seem to be intentionally doing this to be a maverick or to buck the conventional wisdom or in the way that Nixon went to China. He just has no clue what he's doing and wants to build hotels in these places. And it is all a sad, terrible joke. Finally, there were a grand total of 4 proven cases of in-person voter fraud during this election cycle. All 4 were Trump supporters. And 3 of the 4 were caught in states that don't have strict voter ID laws. Those same laws depressed Democratic turnout by 8.8%, but GOP turnout by only 3.6%. And they are justified by the notion that there is widespread in-person voter fraud. It's a hell of a democracy. Anyway, stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Heather Parton.
Bless my heart.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Heather Digby Parton. Heather is an OG blogger at Hullabaloo and also a columnist for Salon. Heather, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
Now, we've exchanged a few short emails, but I haven't spoken to you since the election. It kills me that we had the opportunity to get a left-leaning majority on the Supreme Court for the first time since 1971, and we blew it. I mean, I was born in 1969. I was in diapers the last time the Supreme Court was a constructive institution, you know? And then the bottom line is that for whatever combination of reasons, just enough Democrats stayed home in key states. At least we stuck it to Debbie Wasserman Schultz on the DNC, right?
Well, I mean, there's always silver linings. I guess you can find some. It's interesting, though, Joshua. I just read a piece that I thought was quite interesting. You know, we've all been looking at this, trying to find, you know, you have to go back and analyze and try and figure out what went wrong and look at the other side and see what they did right. And, you know, this is a process made even more difficult this time because of the emotion that we all feel at the election of this, you know, this demagogic cretin, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, yes. This is a very, very difficult one to even look at with any sort of dispassion. But there are people who are doing it. You are, and I am too, as we write and try and sort out what happened. And there have been a couple of things written that I think are interesting. One, I think Dave Roberts wrote a very interesting thing for Vox, in which he kind of did a compilation or global view of all the different things. And what you come out with at the end of reading something like that is, you know, just the knowledge that this is so close. It's such a close race in the Electoral College, and of course Clinton won a very substantial and decisive victory in the popular vote. That, you know, it could have been anything, right? I mean, it was, there are 100 different reasons. Who knows what was decisive? Maybe each voter that voted for Trump over Clinton, that in those places where it mattered, had a different reason for doing it, and all of that could be true. But also, I just read a piece in the Daily Beast about the two pollsters for the campaign. I think his name is Tony Fabrizio for the Trump campaign, and the pollster for the Clinton campaign, Joel Benenson, who had done Obama's campaigns as well. Talking about what they were seeing in the polling. And you know, Fabrizio, contrary to what Trump and Kellyanne Conway keep telling everybody, that they won in a landslide, it was anything but. As Fabrizio put it, he goes, you know, five counties, four in Florida and one in Michigan could have made the difference. I mean, that's how he said, that's all it is, five counties.
Yes.
There were four counties in Florida where more white people came out to vote than expected, and one county in Michigan, Macomb County, a very famous county, the home of the Reagan Democrats, came out in much larger numbers for Trump than one might have expected. That made the difference right there. Again, just reiterating, it could have been anything. But this is what he said. And then the two of them talked about, now this is something that's sort of been undercovered, I think. Both campaigns knew it was going to be very close. And in the last weeks, they were tracking what the pollsters called potential defectors and defectors. These were the kind of swing voters who were going back and forth between third parties and their candidate, and maybe not voting. And that is something that was much more in play this time than usual, because both candidates were very severely loathed by half the country, right? Half the country hated Clinton with a passion. Yeah. Half the country hated Trump. So this defector issue was a big deal, and both pollsters acknowledged it, that this was something they were watching very, very carefully and knew could be decisive. And what they found was, both sides admitted this, Fabrizio for Trump and Benenson for Clinton, was that the Comey letter was a decisive moment because of the timing. They knew that these kinds of issues were moving those defectors off of their candidate and back onto third party. It happened to Trump at earlier points, and it was happening to Clinton. The reason that it made a difference was when it happened. It happened 10 days in, and then it was too late for Clinton to recover. And that was, in their, both pollsters agreed that that was a decisive, one thing they could definitely agree on was a decisive moment in the campaign and may have made the difference. So I thought that was interesting, simply because you think about something like that, it's so capricious that, you know, how does anyone plan for something like that, right?
You know, it's interesting. I find the data so compelling. If you look at late-breaking voters in those key swing states, they went overwhelmingly for Trump. And yet a lot of people on the left say that this is an excuse for a poor mm-hmm. candidate. And it seems like the, you know, that's being shaded by their own kind of tribal or partisan views, because the data themselves seem unambiguous. And by the way, as you said, there was this very, very clear pattern throughout the election. When one candidate was the focus of most of the news stories, that is when Trump's recording of the grab your you-know-what came out, at various points when the media focused on one candidate, the other candidates' numbers rose. And this happened again and again and again. And the final week of the election was all about Hillary Clinton and her emails. And as you say, it proved decisive. But my question, so we have all of these kind of dueling postmortems among progressives, right? We have a white nationalist movement is taking over the White House. And of course, we're fighting amongst ourselves. But my question is whether it's all kind of pointless. I talked about this a bit at the end of last week's show. Of course, we're programmed to ask what went wrong and try to learn lessons for the future. And that's all well and good. But it just seems to me that there were so many unique factors that influenced the outcome that it's a black swan event. You know, I mean, we're not going to nominate another Clinton. I mean, maybe Chelsea someday, but not in the near future. No non-Clinton has been subjected to the kind of like decades-long hate campaign from the right that the Clintons have had. The next nominee will probably take cybersecurity seriously. They won't get their internal emails hacked. The FBI director is unlikely to insert himself into another election. So, yes, there are lessons to be learned. Of course, I think that we should, you know, take stock. That's the case with any losing campaign. But I think that, you know, in the bigger picture, if it was a black swan event, what is it exactly that Democrats need to understand about it to go forward?
Well, I mean, I agree with you. I think that this was, I mean, you want a situation that is, you know, sui generis, it's this one. I mean, this one with a TV star, with the first woman, with it being, you know, with someone who's been in politics for decades compared to someone who is brand new in politics. I mean, the backlash against Barack Obama, I don't think you can underestimate that either. This idea that, I mean, you heard, particularly in the Republican primaries, before Hillary Clinton came on, what you would see in interviews with people all over the country, Republican voters were, you know, they were absolutely furious with Barack Obama. I mean, he was their enemy. So there was that backlash part of it as well. I don't think you can underestimate it. So all of that is not going to be in play in the next election. And I, you know, look, I mean, you and I both know what's really happening here, right? I mean, the loss gives an opening for people to sort of advance their own agenda and, you know, whatever they believe is what the party should have been doing all along. And, you know, there was a pretty, you know, energetic, I guess is one way to put it, primary fight in the Democratic Party, I think, that showed some divisions that are going to, that, you know, now the sort of power struggle is on. For me, I'm actually not all that interested in it for exactly the reasons that you cite. I don't think we're going to be in this place in 4 years. And I think in 2 years, looking at the midterms, I think that particular fight is waged on an individual district basis. And I think people will have to think that through, you know, their own approach to doing that. So I'm less interested in it than a lot of people. I mean, you know, the recriminations, it's natural. You know, you lose, people are going to, you know, the circular firing squad is
sure
always going to take place. And I'm just kind of waiting it out and hoping that, you know, it doesn't
it's
take too long.
It's very frustrating. I mean, this whole debate over identity politics and class politics, as if you can possibly, as if identity and social class are in any way extricable. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Heather Digby Parton. Heather, let me shift gears a little bit. One of Trump's surrogates, Scottie Neal Hughes, she was the one who I don't know if you remember this. Saturday Night Live parodied her, called her a genuine lunatic or something like that. So she told Diane Rehm that there's no such thing as facts. Let me just read. I have the transcript here. I couldn't find usable audio. Let me just read this little snippet. She said, and I quote, "One thing that has been interesting this entire campaign season to watch is that people that say facts are facts, they're not really facts. Everybody has a way. It's kind of like looking at ratings or looking at a glass of half full water. Everybody has a way of interpreting them to be the truth or not truth. There's no such thing, unfortunately, anymore as facts." She was speaking specifically about Donald Trump's claim that millions of undocumented workers and he didn't say dead people, but that's part of the story, the myth. So the sad thing is that she's 100% right. I mean, PolitiFact rated 70% of Donald Trump's statements on the campaign trail mostly false, or pants on fire. Didn't matter. In the final 3 months of the campaign, more people engaged with fake news stories on Facebook than real ones. And on Twitter, you had these automated pro-Trump bots. They drowned out positive messages about Hillary. There was just nonsense. We're swimming in nonsense this election season in a way that, you know, I don't think we've seen before. And now we have a commander-in-chief who can take to Twitter and just drop nonsense, and everybody has to focus on whatever nonsense he drops into the discourse. You know, of course, every president has shaded the truth, has spun, and when they thought that they could get away with it, they've told, like, carefully crafted lies. This is a guy who just spontaneously creates his own fake news. And as a writer and someone who values his membership in the so-called reality-based community, I find all of this profoundly depressing, right? And I do keep in mind that what we do collectively, not just you and I, what we do does have an influence on our side. But in the bigger picture, we have these two very polarized groups of Americans and no neutral arbiter of reality. They don't trust the fact checkers. You know, we don't trust the Media Research Center. Have we reached peak BS, and how do we manage that?
Gosh, you know, I don't know, but it is one of the most vexing problems that we face, if not the most vexing problem, because without having some sort of common understanding of reality, there's no solving any problem that exists in reality. This is very, very difficult, and it's been coming on for a long time. I mean, as you recall, I'm sure, you just go back, you know, to a couple of decades. Newt Gingrich created back in the early 90s, he had GOPAC, which was his sort of educational forum on how to talk about the other side. And it was a sheer propaganda effort, you know, in a really traditional sort of, Orwellian style of using certain words and language to describe your opponents and using other words to describe yourself and sort of creating this kind of atmosphere, I think. And, you know, it went on and on. I mean, the breaking of the sort of common mass understanding or mass acceptance of a certain bottom line reality, as we would see through, say, the news media or the New York Times or whatever, and none of whom have ever been, you know, perfect in this way, but it was an accepted sort of baseline from which we could all kind of, you know, jump off and do our interpretation. Now that stuff is being rejected completely, and it went all the way through the 2000s, you know, the Ron Suskind interview with the Bush official in the Pentagon, where he said, you know, you are members of the reality-based community, we are history's actors, and as we act, then you will go back and you will sit and try to understand, and we will keep on acting.
We create our own reality.
Yeah, we create our own reality, and you are trying to understand what we are doing. I mean, that was basically his concept. And you know, this has been going on for a while, but it really went crazy in this election, because we had that, first of all, you know, I think it's the first time that Facebook and Twitter have been real players in the dissemination of news and how people understand news, and they were real players, and they were both manipulated and also created these silos where people were only seeing things that, you know, were kind of circular they were circulating the same stuff back and forth and never seeing anything but that. And then the mainstream news media did a terrible job of trying to sort all this out, and particularly TV news, although the newspapers certainly didn't cover themselves with glory either, but they did a little bit better. And so now we're in this situation where we even have foreign actors potentially involved. We don't know to what extent or how that was done, but we know they were engaged in hacking and then releasing information, which the news media then disseminated, and it was all one-sided, which is a crazy thing that we've just accepted as being normal. And I don't know what we're going to do, Joshua, because this is going to be very, very difficult for us to sort out. I mean, I kind of feel, I've always worried about being just this person who wrote and, was preaching to the choir, and whether or not that was really worth anything, right? Am I really doing anything that's, making a difference? But I actually kind of think that at this point it actually does, because I think that we have to really try to at least keep half the country on, on the same page,
Yeah, no, I hear you. So here's a conundrum. It seems like Donald Trump can distract us from whatever kind of damaging news story is going on by tweeting something wacky. So this week we had a couple of stories, one about the Trump Hotel, its lease in Washington, D.C. It has a lease with the federal government. The lease states very clearly that no person who is an elected official can have any interest or profit from the property. And he said he was going to put his businesses in a blind trust, but that just means giving it to his kids to manage. And there were appointments, a number of controversial appointments that he made. And yet on Tuesday, we spent the whole day talking about flag burning, because he tweeted out some nonsense about how flag burners should be. He was actually just responding to a Fox News segment. It looks like the timing of that tweet, it went out like 5 minutes after Fox News aired a segment about student protesters burning a flag. So he was just being a kind of an old man yelling at the TV. But it managed to derail the news cycle. So on the one hand, you would say, well, in a perfect world, reporters would learn how to ignore his distractions, provocations, et cetera, et cetera. But here's the thing. When the most powerful man in the world, arguably, tweets out something wacky, that is objectively newsworthy, right?
Absolutely. So I mean, I don't know what to do about this. Yeah, I mean, how do you ignore it? Yeah, and how do you ignore the fact that the man who is going to be the most powerful person on earth, and that's literally true, is talking about just blithely throwing out that people should be denied citizenship for doing a symbolic act of free speech? I mean, that's so crazy that you can't ignore it. And even if it is just an old man screaming at the TV, this happens to be an old man who is sitting in the White House and, with a nuclear button in his hand, I mean, so it's not, he's not just any other old guy that you can just say, oh, grandpa, okay, I'm getting off your lawn. I mean, that is a problem. On the other hand, these big stories, and in fact, the one that you talk about, the conflict of interest story, really is, and I think we talked about this before the election, this is disqualifying of Donald Trump as president of the United States, and it's actually incurable. There's no way he can actually, even if he were to decide to sell everything and tell his family to go find new careers, which is not going to happen, but let's pretend that he did that out of patriotism, or even pragmatic, realization that this was going to cause him problems as president. Even if he did that, to unwind a business like he has would take years, probably longer than the time he would be in office. So it is actually a disqualifying act. And we knew this before the election. This is not news. It's not anything. I mean, this has been out there since the day he announced. And for whatever reason, this was, people talked about Atlantic City, they talked about Trump University, they talked about a lot of things, and his relationships with women across the board. For whatever reason, this one was ignored, and it is crazy to me that that happened. And now that they are trying to deal with it, I think it's his most serious Well, I shouldn't say his most serious problem. It's our most serious problem. Because if he is able to do this and get away with being president while, even if he's saying, you know, I'm distanced myself, my kids are handling it, you know, everybody knows that's not true.
Yes.
And the news media and the political system itself ignores all the conflicts of interest that are going to come up over the course of, I mean, and there are going to be dozens of them. I mean, it's not just his hotel. That's probably the least of it. We're talking about, you know, big buildings being built in Manila and him inviting, you know, the president of the Philippines, Duterte, who is a, you know, a living, breathing nutcase,
yeah,
right up there with Kim Jong-un, and inviting this guy to the White House. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we're talking about here. And if he's able to get away with that, and somehow or another we just adapt ourselves to this reality, we are well and truly a kleptocracy. There is no further, I mean, we cannot call ourselves anything like a republic anymore. This is something very, very different. And, you know, I don't, so, yeah, I mean, I believe I see him tweet out this crazy stuff. Of course, I'm going to comment on it. I may write about it. I can't ignore it. The guy's saying crazy things, and he's going to be the most powerful man in the world. But then there's also this other thing. And I don't know. And his voters don't seem to be even remotely interested in any of that. I mean, they're more interested.
If they're even hearing about it. If they're
even hearing about it.
I'm not sure that they are. And I'll tell you, it's a question that I have is, how significant the media's utter failure to force him to keep it in the news until he had to relent his refusal to release his tax returns.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, it was a crucial, longstanding norm of American elections, and they just let him blow it off. And I wonder to what degree that signaled to him that he can get away with doing things that others just can't. We are almost out of time. Let me ask you, is there anything we can be hopeful about? Do you think they'll overextend and it'll be the kind of disaster that motivates Democrats to vote in the midterms? Because if we can't get one chamber of Congress, not only will they be unable to block Trump but I think maybe the more important point is that they won't be able to investigate his conflicts of interest.
Well, I agree, and it's very concerning because the people who, you know, the investigators, the Javerts who were going to go after Hillary Clinton, chase her to the ends of the earth, like Jason Chaffetz in the House, they're suddenly being very passive about all this. So I don't think we can expect much from them. And that is a problem. If there's ever been, you know, an administration that actually needed oversight,
it's not just
a political witch hunt, it's this one. So that is a problem. I am actually, I don't know, it's so hard for me to, you know, swim my way out of this quicksand at the moment to try and see the future. But I do still have to believe somehow that reality bites, right? That you know, as much as this guy's been able to get away with everything in his life, and in fact, Brian Buettler at the New Republic wrote an interesting article about how what motivates him is the fact that is impunity. He has never paid a price for anything that he's ever done, not really. He's always skated. He's one of those guys that just always gets away with it. And as a result, he's very bold and very confident that he can get away with it. But he's president now, and things are going to happen that are outside his control, and there's going to be everyone in the world is going to be watching him. And one has to assume that at some point something is going to catch up to him. And if it does, let's hope the Democratic Party isn't so hopelessly enmeshed in their circular firing squad that they can't get together and take advantage of the moment and try to put up some roadblocks to stop him. I'm just hoping it isn't something horrifying, you know, a catastrophic terrorist attack or, you know, some kind of economic cataclysm that makes that happen. I'm hoping it's something that's just visible and real and makes a difference. I mean, it did happen to
George W.
Bush.
Hopefully we won't lose an entire city like we did with George W. Bush.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the, I think Katrina was very much responsible for the 2006 midterm wave election that Democrats managed to do, which broke the kind of pattern of low turnout elections favoring the Republicans. Heather, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this week.
My pleasure, Joshua. Anytime.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Dean Baker.
I've never seen a diamond in the flesh. I cut my teeth on wedding rings in the movies, and I'm not proud of my address. In a torn up town, no postcode envy, but every song's like gold teeth, gray goose tripping in the bathroom, bloodstains, ball gowns, trash in the hotel room. We don't care, we're driving Cadillacs in our dreams, but everybody's like crystal Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece, jet planes, islands, tigers on a gold leash. We don't care, we aren't caught up in your love affair, and we'll never be royals. It don't run in our blood, that kind of luck just ain't for us. We crave a different kind of buzz. Let me be your ruler. You can call me Queen Bee, and baby I'll rule. Let me live that fantasy. My friends and I, we've cracked the code. We count our dollars on the train to the party, and everyone who knows us knows we're fine with this. We didn't come for money, but every song's like in the hotel room. We don't care, we're driving Cadillacs in our dreams, but everybody's like crystal Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece, jet planes, or tigers on a gold leash. We don't care, we aren't caught up in your love affair. Let me live that fantasy. Oh, 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 oh. I'm bigger than I ever dreamed, and we'll never be royals. It don't run in our blood, that kind of luck's just ain't for us. We crave a different kind of buzz. Let me be your
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Dean Baker. Dean's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and the author of a gaggle of books. I don't know how this guy finds the time to write so much. The latest one is out now. It's called How Globalization and the Rules of the Market Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And by implication, the poor poorer. And Dean, being an economist, knows that people are price sensitive, so you can download an electronic copy for nothing. The paperback will cost you a few bucks, but if you want to get that free copy, head on over to deanbaker.net or Google it. Dean, welcome back to the show.
So thanks for having me on, Joshua. I just got to point out you left out the first word of the title, rigged.
Rigged. Oh, my goodness. How did
which,
I do that?
Which I came up with before Donald Trump was saying it all over the country.
You know, I was going to ask you if it was a if the title was an echo of Trump's shtick about everything being rigged.
No, I thought it was an appropriate title, but again, it was before, you know, I ever associated. I don't know when Donald Trump first started saying rigged, but I came up with the title long before I heard him saying it.
Well, it's also not an original concept to Donald Trump. In this book, you write about different specific issues, but the broad argument is one that I think readers of the conservative nanny state, the end of loser liberalism will find familiar. Progressives are too focused on redistribution and beefing up the social safety net when it's the rules of the economy that skew our output towards those who write them in the first place. Do you feel like Cassandra, the mythical figure who was blessed with prescience, but then blew off Apollo's advances and he put a curse on her that nobody would believe her. I mean, this is obviously true. You've been saying it for years, but you still hear progressives criticize conservatives as free market fundamentalists. Why do you think this is so hard to get across to people?
I think it's very comforting to think of take the conventional liberal view that, you know, here it is, you know, we're, because most of the people saying it are, you know, relatively well off in the scheme of things. I don't mean to say they're all rich people, but, you know, these are disproportionately professionals, people with advanced degrees who are doing reasonably well in the scheme of things. So it's very comforting to say, you know, I'm doing well, but, you know, I feel bad about, you know, these, you know, people left behind, and, you know, I want to help them out. So we should have, you know, more generous TANF, you know, or food stamps or, you know, something like that. It's a different story to say, well, I actually, you know, I might be smart, I might have worked hard, but a lot of these other people are smart and worked hard, but they didn't get the chances. This is rigged against them. That's a very, very different story, and I think less comforting. So I think, you know, it's very convenient for a lot of people to just sort of accept the conventional liberal view. The other point, and, you know, I hate to be a little condescending here, not to you, I mean, but to profession, you know, my profession, people follow economics, it's a new view. And, you know, I joke about this, but I think it's true that intellectuals have a hard time dealing with new ideas. You know, they're used to the conventional arguments. They defer to authority. So you're saying that, well, how come Paul Krugman isn't saying it? How come, you know, Joe Stiglitz does sort of sometimes say it. I actually think I say it a little better than Joe. I mean, Joe's a great guy, great theorist, but I think in terms of saying things, he's not always the clearest person, I think, for the average reader. But in any case, you know, people defer to authority. And, you know, I'll go back. I was talking about the housing bubble. This was really, really simple stuff. But I couldn't convince people because, you know, they just didn't want to hear it. And I was asking them to do very simple exercises. Look what's going on with house prices. It's never happened before. And I'm using government data, so it's not like I have some, you know, magic stick here. You know, here's a run-up in house prices. We've never seen anything like it before. Rents aren't moving. There's no explanation for it except it's a bubble. But I was asking people to think in a way they hadn't previously, so they were just not going to do it. And I think that's the story here as well.
And to some degree, it doesn't fit easily on a bumper sticker. It's not easy to explain. If you think about, so like conservatives say the government should run its budget like a household. It's one of the stupidest things that they say, but it makes a certain amount of intuitive sense, and it's easy to just get out there in a soundbite when you're on CNN or something like that. I think that's also part of it. So let's dig a little bit into specifics. A lot of left-leaning folks say we should spend money to stimulate the economy. Let's spend a bunch of money on whatever, infrastructure or whatever. But you hear a lot of them promise to pay for their proposals. We saw that even with Bernie Sanders. He offered expansive new policies, but he always said, oh, he'd pay for every cent. You look at this somewhat bipartisan obsession with keeping deficits low in a kind of different way. How does this how does this focus on deficits ultimately hurt working people's bargaining power and keep wages down?
Well, I think a really important aspect of the story is that basically the overall level of demand, the level of output, employment in the economy is a policy choice. And, you know, essentially the government has enormous control over that in how much it chooses to spend and tax. And when we're below full employment levels of output, that's something that can be rectified by the government spending more. Now, it's not the only way. We can get the trade deficit down. You know, we know tools to do that. We could try to push more. You know, the Fed's done this to some extent, try to push more monetary policy. You could always do more. It's not the most effective tool, but you could always do more. So there are other mechanisms. I've also talked about shortening work weeks. You know, it's great if people could work fewer hours. That's more jobs, other things equal. I mean, it's a little more complicated than that, but that is the basic story, and that's basically true. But, you know, when you have something closer to full employment, then workers have a lot more bargaining power, and that means even workers at the bottom of the wage ladder are in a position to achieve wage gains. And the best story I could tell about that is the late 90s. The unemployment rate got down to 4%. Most economists did not think that was possible, but we got the unemployment rate down to 4% as a year-round average in 2000. And we saw all through the late 90s, 97, 98, 99, 2000, even workers, you know, at the bottom of the income layer, 10th and 20th percentile in the income distribution, they were seeing substantial wage gains during that period because they were in short supply. McDonald's had to bid for workers. You know, they were paying, I remember the business press at the time, they were paying bonuses to people who could bring in, you know, a friend, a relative who would work for them. They'd give you $300 or $500, whatever it was. That's how tight the labor market was. And in that context, workers, even in the lowest paying jobs, could see pay increases. So I think that's hugely important. And when you say this is a matter of government, it's a policy decision. We could be in the same situation today if we're prepared to spend the money. And in effect, what we're saying is we're not going to do that. And, you know, we wave our hands and go, oh, my God, deficits, debt, you know, it's going to be horrible on our children. And that's the excuse. But, you know, we could turn around and tomorrow, I mean, literally tomorrow, but in a fairly short order, we could get the economy back to full employment if we were prepared to spend the money to do it.
But it's not just spending. How does inflation or the concern about keeping inflation in check play into this story that you're talking about right now?
Well, what a lot of people would say, it's a little more sophisticated argument. Again, I consider the less sophisticated argument, oh, government debt, that's horrible. You know, and, you know, most economists will acknowledge, okay, well, that's an issue, but, you know, it's not the end of the world. But they'll go, okay, if you push too far, we'll get inflation. And I would agree with that. But the question is, you know, A, how far is too far? And B, how much should we worry about inflation in the sense that we don't just go from, you know, 2% or under 2% inflation now, but whatever, you know, where we're at today, a very low rate of inflation, to suddenly seeing, you know, German-style hyperinflation, you know, from the Weimar period with people having to carry wheelbarrows. It's a very gradual process. There's a lot of research on it, too, so it's not like I'm giving some alternative view. There's a lot of research, and every model I've seen shows that it's a very, very gradual process. So you go, okay, so suppose the inflation rate goes from where it is today to 2.5%, 3%. What's the big deal? I mean, we have a long history of economies doing just fine with inflation rates of 3%, 4%, 5%. I'll grant, we don't want to get to 10%. We don't want to get to 20%. That's a bad story. But it's not going to happen overnight. So to my view, you have a story of incredibly asymmetric gains and losses. You put your foot on the accelerator, we get the unemployment rate down, let's shoot for as low as we can get. We're at 4% in 2000. Maybe we can get there again, maybe not. You know, but in any case, let's see. And if I'm wrong, the inflation rate will start to rise. Well, then you raise interest rates and you slow the economy. To my view, this is just incredibly asymmetric in the sense that the gains from getting lower unemployment, which I should point out disproportionately go to people at the bottom, less educated people, they go to African Americans, they go to Hispanics, they go to the people who need it most. This is the easiest way to help these people out. That's the gains from putting the foot on the accelerator. The downside that we might go too far and the inflation rate rises a little bit, I just see that as, like, trivial. You know, it's cold out today. I wish it were warmer. So what?
But who gains from that bias against allowing inflation to rise?
Well, there's
this is the important question, right?
Yeah. Well, there's two stories here. One, I think the financial sector, not everyone in the financial sector, but there are clear losers in the financial sector. If I have, you know, $1 billion in government debt and, you know, long-term government debt and the inflation rate's higher, that means the interest rates will be higher. That debt will be worth less. I have lost on that. We've seen that a little bit, you know, since Trump got elected. You know, there's been a rise in the long-term interest rate. You know, I think people probably expect we're going to see more inflation, somewhat more inflation. So the value of long-term government bonds have fallen. Same with any long-term loans. So the financial sector could be a loser that way, and we know the financial sector is very powerful. There's a second story that, you know, employers often like workers to not have bargaining power. So you do have a story where employers, you know, would rather not be in a situation of having to offer bonuses to get people to work, you know, at minimum wage or low-paying jobs. So in that sense, you do have employers that could be losers. Now, that's, of course, a mixed story for most businesses because, you know, okay, they're paying their workers more, and, you know, businesses would rather not pay their workers more if they don't have to. On the other hand, there are more people coming through the doors. So that's a mixed story, you know. So they're not unambiguous losers. I'm an unambiguous loser if I have $1 billion of long-term government bonds and, you know, they fall in value by 10%. I'm an unambiguous loser in that case. But, you know, if we're talking about most businesses, you know, a restaurant that has to pay their workers more but has more people coming through the doors, they might be net winners in that story.
Now, it may seem that Wall Street has become a sort of, a proxy for larger ideological arguments. We saw during the primaries, Clinton's speeches to Goldman Sachs, you know, they made her lots of money when she was not in office, but they dogged her campaign nonetheless. why should, and let me ask you this. We always say that Wall Street is not the economy. So when we focus on, you know, the Dow going up or down a little bit, that's not how most, that's not going to affect most people in an immediate or tangible way. Why should an average person, someone with a 401k, feel personally invested in the issue of financial regulation or lack thereof? Like, how does it impact me?
Well, I guess I'd say two ways. One is, you know, you have seen a lot more by way of ups and downs, you know, big ups and downs in the stock market in the last two decades. And, you know, how much of that's due to a lack of regulation is hard to say. But, you know, I will just say that we didn't see, you know, something like the flash crash back in 2010 when, you know, the major indices lost like 10% of their value in, you know, 10 minutes or half an hour. I forget the exact time frame, but basically for nothing. It seems it was a mistake, you know, misreported stock price, and it caught on and had this sort of viral effect because of program trading. That's the sort of thing you didn't see going back, you know, say 40 years. You just didn't see sharp movements like that. So that's kind of, you know, an erratic movement. We, of course, had the crash in 08, you know, which if you had to get out of the market, you know, at that point, you know, you sold at the bottom 2009, you really got screwed. I mean, so I think part of that is connected to a lack of regulation. I'm not going to say the whole story because I think it is more complicated than that, but I think we have seen these big erratic movements, and we didn't used to see movements like that. The other story is that it's just a waste. It's a drag on the economy. And, you know, this is one of the points I've been trying to drive home, and actually I've, you know, just doing more work on it, writing on it. I really drove it home to myself. We have over 2% of our GDP is devoted to the financial sector, very narrow, just people trading stocks and bonds and commodities, you know, commodity futures. That's over 2% of GDP now. It's about 2.5% GDP. We're talking about, you know, somewhere around $450-500 billion a year. That's about an increase, a fivefold increase from where we were in 1970, measured as a share of the economy. So you go, what are we getting for that? Do we think somehow capital is better allocated today than it was, you know, 40 years ago? I think you'd be hard-pressed to say that. We're more secure in our savings. I don't think anyone would say that. So that's just a straight-out drag on the economy. And, you know, again, someone points to argue in my book that if we could reduce the size of the financial sector, the most immediate tool is a financial transactions tax, but there are other things in there as well. If we could reduce the size of the financial sector, we're eliminating the waste. This is the same benefit to us as if, you know, we had the Department of Waste, Fraud, and Abuse that Reagan used to, you know, people always joke that he thinks there's a Department of Waste, Fraud, and Abuse that he's going to eliminate. You know, we could just find, you know, $200 billion of government waste. We'll just zero it out. Well, of course, we'd want that. You know, if it's actually really waste, let's just get rid of it. Well, we have a lot of real waste on Wall Street, and it disproportionately goes to the richest people in the country. We have people earning tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions a year, running these hedge funds and trading for, you know, Goldman Sachs and the other big banks, and they're adding nothing to the economy. So that's straight out of our pockets. The same thing as a tax. It's just through mechanisms most people don't see.
And folks, in the book, Dean details in infuriating terms the kind of sweetheart deals these hedge funds and private equity traders are setting up for themselves. Let's talk about trade a little bit. It's been a big issue in this election, obviously. Most people think trade deals are about ships full of bananas and, I don't know, microchips passing each other on the open seas. But that's not what especially the wealthy countries' primary concern is. Haven't we gotten rid of most tariffs already?
We have, and this is, again, it's quite striking, you know, an area I've written on both in the book and then elsewhere, that, you know, you continue to hear the rhetoric, you know, it seems now the Trans-Pacific Partnership's dead with, you know, Trump winning the election. But, you know, you continue to hear the rhetoric that this was advancing free trade. And it really has gotten, you know, just totally disingenuous and, you know, just straight out dishonest that in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we already have trade deals with 6 of the 11 countries. You know, we have Canada in there, we have Mexico. The formal trade barriers, you know, tariffs, quotas, they're zero or very near zero in these cases. And even the ones we don't, Japan's the biggest country that we don't have a trade deal with already that's in the TPP. We trade a vast amount with them, and the barriers, the remaining barriers between us and Japan are very small. That's really not what the deal's about. It's about putting in place a business-friendly structure of regulation. And, you know, it sets up these special investor tribunals, investor state dispute settlement mechanisms that are extrajudicial and frankly just, when I first heard about it, I could not believe that. I thought the person didn't, you know, was a conspiracy theorist, because it's kind of bizarre, but they're real. They're part of it. So it sets up these tribunals, there's special rights for foreign investors. Very hard to see why you would want that, why you would need that. And then the other part, they're very much focused on increasing patent and copyright protections, which are protectionism. You know, this is why we pay a lot of money for our prescription drugs. It's because we have patent protection. So the idea that somehow this is about free trade and this is some sacred cause, that's just not true. And the people saying that, you know, if you want to be generous, they don't know what they're talking about. I think more often they're deliberately misleading people.
I feel like the media has done a better job of dropping the word free. I think that the first time we talked about this, which is probably 10 years ago, they were always described as free trade deals. And now I see them much more frequently just described as trade agreements. Is that my imagination?
No, that's true. And I followed very, very closely. You know, of course, I have my blog, Beat the Press, and that's one of the things I do there. And I see much more frequently that they simply call them trade deals, which, you know, again, if you're not trying to, you know, advocate for it, that's what a news story should call it. You know, it's a trade deal. It's not about free trade.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Dean Baker. Dean, I'm over time with you. Do you have to run, or do you have a few more minutes?
I got a few more minutes, sure.
Now, you said that we don't have a trade deal with Japan, but we do have a trade deal with Japan. We have the WTO system. It sets out a series of rules governing international trade. Almost all countries are signatories. I don't know, maybe like not North Korea, but most of the world. It has an enforcement mechanism. Politicians in both parties keep talking about how they'd make better deals. Do we need new trade deals?
No, we don't. You're right, of course, about the WTO. I mean, so I was talking about a country specific like NAFTA, but you're absolutely right. I mean, just about every country, again, North Korea, I don't believe in the WTO, but just about every country in the world, and certainly any country with a substantial economy, is in the WTO. So those put sharp limits on tariffs and do have, as you say, a dispute settlement mechanism. So if, you know, a country, we think they're discriminating against us based on a tariff or some non-tariff barrier, we take it there and, you know, they rule as they rule. So, you know, question, do we need additional trade deals? It's very hard to see that we do. And insofar as the trade deals are about increasing, you know, patent and copyright protection, I don't at all want to see them. I mean, I really don't want to make poor people in Vietnam pay more for prescription drugs. I don't see us having any interest in that. I understand Pfizer wants that, but yes. I don't see how the United States as a country has an interest in that. And that's a lot of what we're doing here. And, you know,
this is my view. Like, we just don't, we have basic rules of the road are well established, and we just don't need any more. And frankly, that is a view that is discarded as crack pottery by a lot of people. Like, how can you? I hear a lot as a critic of the existing kind of trade regime. I hear, well, how would you do it differently? And I say, well, we've already established these rules. We don't need to go further, because they are about imposing, as you say, a regulatory framework on domestic on countries' domestic policies. That is, it's about overriding the domestic regulatory framework for an international one-size-fits-all standardized framework that's frankly dictated by the lobbyists in the most powerful countries, and they use a lot of coercion and arm twisting to get poorer countries to sign on. Now, the conventional wisdom on trade is that it provides a net benefit, which is diffuse and hard to see. Like, we all make a few more bucks thanks to international trade and the expansion of international trade. But then the pain and the dislocation is concentrated and really visible. So in this election, we've had a lot of lower income people who've been hosed by trade, and a lot of them believe that Donald Trump could fix it. Let's say, for the sake of argument, and only for the sake of argument, because I think this guy's a complete con artist. For the sake of argument, let's say he was sincere. Could he actually alter this international system in any way, in any significant way, beyond maybe getting some riders that have some sort of marginal impact at the fringe?
Yeah, absolutely could. And in particular, I'd focus on China, you know, and he had, this was certainly an issue in the campaign. And, you know, he'd go around saying that, you know, we have all these complaints against China. And first and foremost, he'd talk about their currency. And they do manage their currency. I prefer the term manage. You know, he'd say manipulate, but I'd say manage because this is open. We don't have to catch them doing it. They have a targeted exchange rate. And it holds down the value of the currency against the market value. Again, this is something I think a lot of reporters have gotten wrong. China holds in excess of $4 trillion of reserves at this point. And, you know, it's a big economy, but $1 trillion by most standards should be plenty. And if they sold off that additional $3 trillion in reserves, there's no doubt about it. Their currency would rise, the dollar would fall. So they do manage their currency. And I think that is something that you could address in negotiations. But, you know, Trump puts it as though he's going to get in there and, you know, pound his fist on the table, and he's going to make China, you know, raise the value of their currency. He's going to make them respect Pfizer's patents on drugs. He's going to make them give access to Goldman Sachs and their financial markets, you know, and all these other things. Well, that's not the way it's going to work. China's, you know, obviously a big, powerful country. We could negotiate with them and, you know, we could say, okay, this is important for us, and we'd have to make concessions on things they want from us. I don't know exactly what that would be, but that would be a negotiation process. And if he made currency the priority, which, you know, in my view, it should be, he could certainly have an impact there. So, you know, so the answer to that is yes. But, you know, the real question is this his agenda? And, you know, at this point, I really have no idea.
Dean Baker, we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us this week.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Folks, the book is called How Globalization and the Rules of the Market Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. You should check it out. We didn't have time. I had a couple of questions about corporate governance, how that impacts people, how that rigs the economy in favor of those who already have a good situation. You could get a free copy of the book at deanbaker.net. I recommend that you do. I'd also like to thank Heather Digby Parton. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. You can also send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I would like to thank Crooks and Liars, Heather Digby Parton again, and the Smirking Trump, formerly the Smirking Chimp, for letting me host the show over at the Joints. Of course, I would like to thank you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.